All right, well, we can throw this open for questions. Is anybody, and you know, use the microphones, please. I'll try to start. I would ask Amy Lischko. A lot of people have been really sort of rooting for Massachusetts, but one of the concerns is, will the numbers mesh? You know, will the premium be low enough that people take the insurance? Can you tell us? I mean, you're starting to actually put some of those numbers on paper. Can you tell us how optimistic you think this is, you are about these numbers meshing?
Well, we just got through a first round of negotiations with the health plans for the subsidized product last week, and I can say that those are coming in promising in a way that, and those are probably the most important as far as can the state afford this? Because for the above 300, it's more an issue of can we make it affordable for people that are going to be paying out of their own pocket. And it looks like that's going to be reasonable. Now, I think moving forward, we also have to put in place cost containment strategies, because at some point we didn't allow for huge inflation, the continuation of the inflation that we've been seeing. So we do have to get a handle on the growth in healthcare costs. And I think getting consumers more involved, making costs and quality information more transparent, doing some of those things, and also having other cost strategies are going to be important moving forward.
Yeah, sir? A few questions. There's been some controversy over the number of uninsured in Massachusetts. And it's been talked about that these were phone interviews, that assumes that people have phones, that assumes that they can understand the languages being spoken. So would you comment on that? And the second question on the insurance industry, I understand that the CEO of United Healthcare is being compensated at $1.6 billion this year. Could you tell us something about insurance industry costs of doing business and how much of it is profit and that kind of stuff, the overhead? And are there any data on the health savings accounts people of consumers being able to understand what quality health care is, and how are they educated to determine which provider is going to give them that quality?
I'll take the first question and then open it up to you guys. I've been involved in this debate on the uninsured numbers for probably about 8 years. We started our first survey in 1998 and became familiar with all the numbers that were floating around. I think we had validation by the Urban Institute's National Family Survey that was done several years, which came up with the same numbers that we came up on altering years. And they used in-person interviews in addition to telephones. We also, our first year out, did an in-person and telephone survey. The numbers were not statistically different. So and it's very expensive to do those field interviews, as CPS will tell you. So we feel confident that, at least in Massachusetts, and it may not be true across the country, there's cell phone-only households that are much more prevalent in other parts of the country. But in Massachusetts, we feel that the state-sponsored telephone random digit dial survey is the best estimate that we can come up with at this point. It's not perfect. It's an estimate, and it has a confidence interval around it. But we feel pretty confident that those numbers are good.
I would kind of echo the issue of the survey, because I think other states have done similar kinds of research, and I've heard them discuss the research that they've done, and the results have been consistent with what Massachusetts has found, that, in fact, that the uninsured numbers have been overreported, that, in fact, in a number of cases, the uninsured are eligible for existing government programs that they're not signed up for, and I think the results across the country, there have been a number of states who have indicated in at the NAIC and other forums that, in fact, their numbers match what Massachusetts has actually found. On the cost issue, I'm not going to talk, obviously, about the compensation of the United CEO. I have no idea about that. I haven't followed that whatsoever. But I would tell you that when you sit down and you look at you know, the common Medicare number. We've published a piece on this. And when you look at the administrative expenses in Medicare and you compare them to the actual administrative expenses in private insurance based on our analysis, that, in fact, they match up pretty close, that Medicare numbers are very close administratively to large group numbers because a number of items, and I did not do the study, so you can take a look at it on our website, but a number of items are not reported in the global Medicare budget and are not part of the budgeting process. So the administrative expenses, in fact, in the private market match, at worst, the public market expenses. And, you know, I'd also point out that the private market does a lot more with that administrative expense than Medicare does. Do you have nurse health lines broadly in Medicare that's paid for by the government? A number of health plans offer this. You have, you know, individuals helping to manage the care of people who are going through serious medical conditions, including transplants, to try to move them into centers of excellence. They do a lot of work on the health plan side to both control the costs as well as to ensure that individuals get good quality care. And so, you know, I think we get pretty good value relatively for those administrative expenses compared to what we see in Medicare, where we see providers seeing allegedly hundreds of patients a day and receiving payments for those. That kind of thing doesn't, you know, I'm not going to say it doesn't ever happen in the private market, but I would say that it's not nearly as common. You need to understand that Medicare pays claims. That's all they do. They don't manage anything. They get a claim in and they pay it, whether or not it's a duplicate, whether or not it's, you know, a variety of things. And quite frankly, government should probably be spending more on administration than they're currently spending. On the issue of health savings accounts, the data is coming out. It's moving that direction. We've got 3 million people signed up with more than 3 million people signing up for HSAs as we speak, and that number seems to be expanding every 12 months, and they're going to start demanding more information on quality and quality of care, and a number of states have started moving that direction to provide that coverage. I'm sure Greg knows, has been following it a little bit more closely.
Yeah, I would just add, I've been doing health policy for 30 years now, and ever since I started and long before that, public policy people have been hectoring people to pay better attention, to become better educated consumers, and it's all fallen on deaf ears until recently. And I think HSAs have finally created a demand for that kind of quality and price information that has never existed before. We're not there yet, but I can tell you, I go to a lot of conferences, and that's where all the venture capital is going, the entrepreneurial energy, the innovation is going into systems and services to provide people with precisely that kind of information, actionable information that they can actually do something with. And we're not nearly where we need to be, but I think it's growing as quickly as the internet did 15 years ago. Or 10 years ago. How long ago was it? Seems like yesterday.
Ma'am, can you say your name before you ask your question?
Sure. Kelly Hunt, the New York State Health Foundation. First, I just want to applaud what was done in Massachusetts. I think, you know, it was the public policy process at its best, and I know that all eyes are watching you right now. It's not easy to be in the limelight. So, and I think that there are a lot of evaluative efforts going towards studying what's working and not working, and I think that we can all benefit from that. So just wanted to say that. And turning towards the more provocative discussion from Greg Scanlon about you know, making people aware of the cost of healthcare, I think is what you were getting at. And you know, hearing all this talk about defined contribution and health savings account, I'm really intrigued by it because in my heart of hearts, I also believe that people need to understand how much things cost. But right now, you can't. If somebody tells you that you need an MRI, you can't just pick up the phone and call, you know, the center that's offering MRIs and say, how much is it going to cost me to do this? They just can't tell you that information right now. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on how to start pushing cost transparency because it's something I'm thinking about a lot right now. Thanks.
Good for you. To some extent, you can do that, and just making that call is helpful. You know, certainly the MRI business is very competitive, at least in most of the country. I don't know how it is in New York, and people our, you know, marketing MRI services, including cost information. But that's just a small example. It's a lot harder to do in hospital inpatient care, for instance. Actually, in my state, Maryland, we have an all-payer hospital rate setting system, so it's fairly easy to get hospital cost information in Maryland. But there's a lot going on there, like I say. Meanwhile, it shows up in very, I got diagnosed with blood pressure, with high blood pressure just recently, and my physician prescribed me, as it turned out, the most expensive medication on the market. And I was paying directly out of pocket for that. If I just had a normal copay, I would never have had any idea what it cost, and it would have affected me at all. Because it was so expensive, I called him up and said, look, doc, can't we find something a little more affordable? You know, and it turns out that, sure enough, there are 20 or 25 different medications for blood pressure with a whole wide variety of cost, and he didn't know that until I made the call. You know, and that kind of phone call made him pay attention to the cost. So, it's not just a simple one-time solution. It's a process that we're talking about here—a process of growth and education and change that'll take some time. You know, I certainly concede that.
Sir,
I just wanted to ask Mr. Scanlon: we could eliminate employer-based health care in the United States of America tomorrow morning simply by repealing the tax deduction employers get for such plans. And let me ask you, do you think the country is ready for such a step? And if so, what would you see as being the replacement for the employer-based system?
No, I don't think it's ready, and it may never be. It's not so much the employer tax deduction as it is the exclusion for the employee of the value of the benefits. The employer tax deduction will always apply because it's compensation, and it's a cost of doing business. What we can do, I mean, some employers are very, very good at this. Other employers are just terrible at it. I mean, I used to live in Maine, where I worked at a print shop, biggest commercial print shop in Portland. And my boss didn't know squat about healthcare and wasn't particularly adept at doing this. And we had 75 employees. There was no particular advantage in getting coverage through the job except for the tax policy. So if we equalize the tax treatment, I think the employers that are good at it and adding value to the system would continue to do so. The employers that don't give a damn would get out of it, and they probably should.
And I would point out that we've done a lot to make it difficult for especially small employers and expensive for them to offer coverage. And we've a number of states, I mean, we're dealing with an issue right now across the country related to HRAs. And in a number of cases, small employers who are not offering coverage want to offer some help to their employees through an HRA where they can put some money in for the employees. The employees can use that money, you know, whatever amount it is, you know, to purchase medical expenses or to purchase health insurance. A number of states are considering defining that as group insurance and basically banning that process. We've made it more and more difficult for employers to provide any help. You know, mandated benefits, community ratings, so on and so forth, have an impact on affordability and availability of health insurance.
I'm Bob Ward with the Business Council's Public Policy Institute. I have a question for Amy Lischko, and perhaps the other gentleman might have a comment as well. When we compare Medicaid costs from in New York versus other states, we look at Massachusetts, and you seem to have a pretty highly regarded hospital system and seem to take care of your older folks and do other things. But here in New York, we spend about two-thirds more per capita on Medicaid overall than you do. And we're trying to figure out how the heck you do it. And what is it that we're doing? I know you obviously know more about your own system than New York's, but perhaps you know a little bit about New York and could point us to some of the areas where we might learn from what Massachusetts does.
Yeah, I was actually surprised by those numbers myself. I am not familiar with the two systems side by side, but I'd be happy to look into that a little bit. I know that we have the area that we've done the most work in is our pharmacy area, where we've really had a lot of cost containment strategies and really gotten a handle on that. Our hospital costs, though, it surprises me that we're lower than you, because we really have not done very much in that area except, you know, maybe underpay providers. But we haven't done a lot of management strategies in that area. So I'd be happy to look at the data side by side and work with your group on that.
Pharmacy efforts, I assume, are relatively recent.
I would say past 5 years.
Yeah. But this problem goes back well before that, if you look at the data. So perhaps that's not the what has made the difference. I don't know if the gentleman have any observations. Okay, thank you.
The real question is how New York does it, not how Massachusetts. Yes, sir.
Sheridan Biggs, Union Graduate College. Recently, a few prominent healthcare people in this area have made public statements in favor of so-called single-payer approaches and make a statement as though all we have to do is that and all these problems go away. If it's so simple, why is it you guys never bring it up?
It is simple. It's insanely simple. It's a simple solution that doesn't work. You know, when you sit and look at the data and look at the experience, and Greg had some of these slides of people who are sick. I mean, you know, the problem with a lot of the single payer systems is it's great when you don't have to pay in, but when you get sick, that's when you have the problem. And the kinds of care and the horror stories you hear from England and from Canada are just you know, scary, and you know, they just simply have not worked anywhere.
Let me just make the point that Canada is the only country in the world with a true single-payer system. The UK really isn't. The UK has a national health service, which is essentially what we think of as socialized medicine, but also has a very vibrant private healthcare system alongside of it. Germany, France, Switzerland, none of these countries have single payer. Canada is the only country in the world with a model like that, and the Canadian Supreme Court just ruled that it's illegal. So I don't concern myself very much with people that advocate single payer. I mean, they are very, very much outliers.
And I would just add that the Canadian system works not as bad as it would work if the United States wasn't a border country where many people seek care when they have a long, long, long wait up in Canada. So,
and in fact, I would highlight that a number of companies are looking at going into the Canadian market and selling plans to pay for care for them to come back in the United States.
Mike, the idiot from Ohio who believes in free enterprise. Lady from Massachusetts, have you made estimates? One of the big free lunches from these connectors, exchanges, whatever, is the reduction of an insurance overhead. Do you have estimates on that, what you're going to get savings on that versus what usually gets in the small group market?
Well, we have estimates on what the merging of the non-group and the small group market will do to premiums, both for individuals and small groups. I haven't seen estimates on the overhead costs and the reduction in those. So I don't know if the connector has worked through some of those issues yet, but I haven't seen those figures.
I have a question for I think we'll start with JP. And maybe I'm putting you on the spot, but New York has a lot of mandates on its health insurance. That's kind of your area. I was wondering which of the mandates that you're familiar with in New York you think should be the, if we were ever to get to the place where we wanted to get rid of mandates, would be your first picks, and also what you think about the brand new mental health parity law.
First, you know, I would point out, you know, and I didn't have this as a prop, but again, this is available from our website, and it's a great book, and it describes, you know, the problem that led to the reform in Massachusetts and the costs in New York. And, you know, I would lump community rating and guarantee issue in with the mandated benefits. And those are far more expensive and have a far bigger impact than anything that, you know, the state mandates. Going back to the mental health parity issue, I think what we feel
my position has always been that if employers want it, you know, we're going to put it on the plan. In the case of a company I had worked for years ago, in a number of states, as you may know, from 2 to 15 lives, maternity is an optional coverage. Eventually, the company decided it was far better and far more cost-effective, because it was a popular benefit, to add it to all those policies automatically without, you know, individuals having a choice. So there, the company is mandating its own coverage. Broadly, when you take a look at what's inside a lot of the insurance plans, I mean, a diabetes mandate is almost ridiculous, because I'm not aware of any plan that doesn't cover diabetes. So some of the mandates really don't have, and that's, if you take a look at our website, our mandate in the states, we came up with a consensus estimate based on common definitions of what we think a lot of the mandates cost. And in a number of cases, I would concede that they cost very little. And in fact, some of them may even have negative costs, second surgical opinions, those sorts of things. In fact, lower the overall premiums. But other mandates have tended to be more expensive, and mental health has tended to be one of them. And what we've advocated for is, you know, choice, not necessarily saying that you don't mandate it, but to mandate that, you know, that employers have the choice to whether or not to purchase it. And we think that that's a better approach.
EJ McMahon, Empire Center. On the issue of health savings accounts and consumer choice, it's been noted that one of the challenges to increasing the popularity of such kinds of insurance is a lack of information for the consumers and a lack of consumer understanding of the policy. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about a small company that had moved to HSAs greatly to its financial benefit, but initially the greatest hurdle was explaining the new policy to the employees and getting the employees information about issues such as drugs and other aspects of the policy. I have a question on two other aspects, and I'm wondering if each of you have run into this. In attempting to find out what's going on with the HSAs, a couple of things I've noticed or have heard are, one is that brokers don't understand it and thus don't like to sell it, and that number two, that banks have been slow in setting up accounts. And Taryn and I were just discussing this yesterday. Bank of America, which is my bank and his, a very large regional bank in throughout the eastern United States, does not have an HSA, doesn't set up HSAs, not available. This was also a problem with MSAs, you may recall, which were more limited by law, that it was very hard to get one. Do you have information on this and on these two aspects of the issue of rolling out HSAs?
Well, I would point out that, you know, the first problem with MSAs is obviously it had a limit on the number of policies that could be sold, which kept a lot of the big players out of the marketplace. I think we're getting there with HSAs. You know, there's 3 million people, as I stated before, that currently have an HSA. Those numbers are doubling every 12 months. So, you know, there are estimates that there'll be 10, 12, 14 million people in a few years with HSA coverage. There's over $1.5 billion in assets in HSAs currently in health savings accounts. So, you know, these things take time. HR managers, I think, are one of the people who are having a hard time understanding it and moving that direction. I think we are seeing a big effort, as Greg indicated, to expand information. A number of companies are expanding the amount of information that's available themselves. Hospital associations and providers are expanding their information as well, because patients are demanding it. When you get to a certain point, when enough of your patients demand it, you're just going to have to provide it.
Yeah, let me just add that there are some brokers that are pretty misinformed about it also, and are delivering false information. But I think these folks find that their clients are not very happy when that happens, and if they'd like to stay in business, they have sort of an imperative to become better educated. The banks are really interesting, though, because the banks, I don't know about Bank of America, but a lot of banks are looking at the entire healthcare financing market as a huge opportunity, and it's not just in HSA administration, but it's in information transactions, that sort of thing. I mean, when you look at what the banks do with ATMs, for instance, they're light years ahead of the insurance industry in terms of consumer information technology. The American Bankers Association has a task force that's working on this, making recommendations to its member banks, and I think they're going to be in it just in an enormous way very soon.
I want to ask you about something that puzzles me. I'm sure you're all familiar with the 80-20 rule in healthcare, which is that 20% of the population is accounting for 80% of the costs. And some studies actually show a smaller percentage of people accounting for more of the costs. And so that 20% of people require intensive services for which it's actually rather difficult to shop. You know, when you need surgery, you need it now, and you'll usually rely on your doctor's recommendation. And this is probably going to continue. So I don't understand what HSAs are going to do for that, since an HSA is essentially a plan with a large deductible, and once you're past that deductible, most of them are basically PPOs, which don't provide any care management. Not that care management would be a good idea under Mr. Scanlon's model, since we don't want to interfere with a patient-physician relationship. And so I guess I'm not clear how individual insurance or HSAs really do more than skimming the surface of the high-intensity services that account for the bulk of costs in the American healthcare system today. Maybe you could help me with that.
Well, they don't directly. They're not a panacea. I don't think anyone's ever suggested that they are. They do help people in those arenas where people are capable of functioning intelligently. But yeah, I mean, if you're a burn victim, you're not going to shop around for burn treatment centers and that sort of thing. And there's certainly a role there for some kind of case management program on top of the HSA stuff. So I don't think it's a criticism of HSAs that they don't do everything that needs to be done in healthcare. I think they do a lot, and they start moving the vectors in the right direction. But you're absolutely right. I mean, interestingly though, I would point out that even the Commonwealth Fund has discovered recently that people with very high expenditures do better financially in an HSA program than they do in a traditional PPO. They actually have fewer out-of-pocket costs, and that was a major concession, I think, by Commonwealth.
Yeah, I think what you find on that is that the maximum out-of-pocket at worst of an HSA matches the private market. You know, for people who are seriously ill, or in a lot of cases, the out-of-pocket is actually lower. But I would also point out that while, you know, a majority of the patients may not be able to shop on an expenditure basis, may not be able to shop for their health care, that doesn't mean that a health savings account doesn't have an impact on their costs as well. Because as you move through the system and people are demanding more information on payments and those sorts of things, most payments are based on, you know, percentage based off their charge rate. And as transparency moves forward and you realize that this hospital is way out of whack with the rest of the market, and that's publicized, and they look bad publicly, you know, that's going to force their base charges relatively down. And so as a result, the net effect on the economy may be that even in those cases, unless they want to cherry pick the conditions, that their rates may over time go down as a result of competition because of the other procedures that are performed at the hospital as well. I think that, for example, in the case of Wisconsin, they've got the Wisconsin Hospital Association, which has agreed to publish information in every region in the state and to compare both the managed care price and the standard price based on the procedures. There's a strong interest in a number of legislatures to look at it based on, you know, procedure rate, you know, the most common procedures, based on, you know, just asking for availability, so on and so forth. So patients are going to start, as they're paying more for their own, they're going to start demanding more of that information.
We have time for a couple more questions over here.
Dr. Richard Propp, could you cite me some references supporting the idea that the outcomes in Canada are worse for coronary disease or cancer and any other illness? And could you also tell me what the waiting times are for the 15% of the population that are uninsured in this country?
Yeah, the speaker at lunch maybe will answer those questions. I don't have that specific information. But I would tell you that when you look at studies of the kinds of care that's available in Canada, and you look at the wait times, and I will tell you that, you know, there was strong interest in a product that that my company had marketed in Canada years ago, and people are coming over. I mean, if you're telling me that people are not coming over to receive care at the end of the year, sure. Sure. You can look those up. It's broadly available.
Our last question.
This is Suri Putta. My name. I'm an engineer. In the engineering field, things work very differently. You know, prices are always consumer-driven, and costs are, again, controlled by the producers, and those who price overprice, they go out of business. So things are very much in control. When I hear of public policy applying the same analogy may appear very naive. That's what my son tells me anyway. He just took a job with the U.S. Senate Republican Policy Committee on the healthcare policy. Some of his interests generated when he was at Kennedy School working with summertime with the Massachusetts agency. But the naive questions doesn't appear to be very naive after I hear Greg Scanlon's presentation of the consumer-driven healthcare policy. I can see why it can't work. And I know it's massive. It can't be totally be applied overnight. Everybody spends so much money. U.S. government spends money. States spend money. Employers spend so much money. We pull up all this money so much together, appear to be many, many billions of dollars. Could we experiment with allocate a third of that money to the catastrophic insurance, then third of money to experimenting, whatever you're doing, other third of money going into the health savings accounts. Everybody will have health savings account. This money will be put into their account, and they manage that. And as if it succeeds, then the other parts can go into that as well. So they will manage their account. They will not expire. The money would stay there. If they manage well, the money will stay there longer. They had to incur additional expenses. They had to find some other way. And as far as the catastrophic insurance, there is a governmental participation to cover that part.
So is there a question?
The question is, why is it so naive to think in that fashion? And so I can convey to my son.
I think that's an excellent idea, you know, I'm not sure we'll ever get quite that systematic about it. But one of the interesting things about health savings accounts, I mean, it's an experiment, and we're getting empirical evidence now about what the most effective balance is between insurance coverage and cash payment. You know, and I mean, obviously, burn victims need insurance to pay for those services. But if you're just going to go see a doctor for your annual checkup, it's wasteful to process that claim through an insurance mechanism. It doesn't make any sense to do that. It's more efficient just to pay cash. Now, where is the dividing line between that office visit and the burn victim? Is it $2,000, $5,000, $10,000? We don't know the answer to that. You know, where is the optimal break between cash payment and insurance coverage? And we're trying to get some information that'll help clarify that. And I think your idea is wonderful.
Thank you. One little question. Why are there restrictions on this health savings account that you contribute to it, which if you're not using it, it would expire at the end of the year?
No.
No, they don't.
That's what's different about health savings accounts. Flexible spending accounts expire. Right.
Yeah, even in that, why are they having such a restriction that must be used or else you will lose?
Right. It's
politics.
Stupid.
Well, I'd like to ask for a final round of applause for our panelists.